now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything. Well, today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace, which is an all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. And for a free trial and 10% off, all you have to do is go to squarespace.com and use the offer code CALLEN8. You know, I always say I won't accept any sponsors that I don't believe in or that I don't use myself. I don't use Squarespace, but my friend does. And I actually watched him create a bunch of really good websites in, you know, I think he created like five of them in an hour. It was unbelievable. And they looked incredibly professional. And I'll tell you, if you're not as, and he's pretty savvy when it comes to, you know, computers and stuff. But if you're not that savvy, the great thing is they have an incredibly easy to use support team. You can get them anytime, 24/7, and they're always there to help. Just it's $8 a month, which includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. And it really, they really actually have, I looked at it, they actually have some really cool features and these new designs, and it's really just these incredible style options. And it really allows you to create a very unique website. So I have to say that I am happy that they're sponsoring this, because I actually believe in the product. I think it's excellent, and it's a good example of how technology is making it easier for the everyday layman like myself to have an experience that reaches a lot of people and make it look very professional. And Squarespace is very good at that. So if you want a great website that's very easy to create and costs virtually no money, go to squarespace.com. And if you type in the offer code CALLEN8, you'll get 10% off.
Did it not come through?
No worries. We figured it out. At least we're talking to each other now. That's what matters, my friend. Thanks so much for calling. You're in Australia, I guess.
Yeah, I am. I'm in Sydney. What's the time there?
We're at 5:24 p.m. over here. So we're just excited to have you. Loved your book.
5:24 p.m. I always forget. It's such a long. It's weird. What are we now? We're now 10:24.
Are you
a long way away from us in time terms, aren't you?
I know. Are you? Do you live there? Are you doing research for another book, or what are you doing?
You there?
Yeah, are you researching a book, or are you? Do you live in Australia now?
I actually live in Australia. I'm at Sydney University now. So I was at Cambridge, but I've been at Sydney for about the last 2.5 years or so. It's sort of it's a kind of slightly weird place to be doing ancient world things, but it's
in the very new world, indeed.
Yeah, no, exactly. New. Well, you know, it gives you a sense of perspective, doesn't it? But the strange thing about Australia, especially Sydney, is that they're obsessed with sort of ancient world studies.
Really?
So there's a massive... Yeah, because I don't know why that is. I mean, I'm still trying to get to grips with why that is. But I think it's because they've got so many immigrants from Greece, Lebanon, Italy, you know, like America was. You know, lots of people came here to escape, you know, whatever else was going on in Europe. Mm. And I think also that's that sort of sense in which... there's always this sort of myth that here's sort of terra nullius, you know, the sort of idea that it has no history. And so I think there's been a lot of sort of, you know, bringing in of sort of European history. But the numbers of people you get doing, say, for instance, our Greek and Roman courses here, we get 300 people doing it in the first year.
Wow.
You'd never get that in any British or American university, ever.
Well, that brings me to a question. And it's funny because I love the book, by the way. And I thought to myself, I always say to young people, I say, you know, reading history is a very important thing. Well, they say why. And then, well, you know, there are a lot of answers to that, right? It's the history, it's the study of surprises, the study of conflict, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it gives you perspective, and we all know the reasons why. But I thought to myself, you know, why write a book about Carthage? Even though we all know about it, it's funny because it doesn't bear necessarily any relevance in our everyday life. However, I think 95% of the people I know, regardless of their education, knows something about Carthage, knows
can imagine what it would be like, or at least the horrors of what it'd be like for a civilization that has stood for 700 years to fall like that. What got you to write about this, and why?
I think for a start, I mean, I think it particularly speaks to, I think it particularly speaks to North Americans, actually. And I'll tell you why I think this, because the moment ago, I have to say, I've started to write a book on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And so I've been looking at whole ideas of decline, of destruction, etc. And of course, America, and in fact, some respects, the West, we've been obsessed with the idea of our own decline and destruction, almost from the moment of our sort of creation.
That's very interesting.
If you look at Benjamin Franklin writing about America, saying, you know, within decades of your country sort of getting started, you're worrying about its demise.
Well, you know, it's funny because there's a legend that Franklin, when he came out after drafting the Constitution with the founding fathers, and he said, the woman said, "What have you done?" And he said, "What have you created?" or something. And he said, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." So that, you're right. There's always been this idea.
You got the same sort of thing, you know, and a couple of hundred years later, you've got Charles Dickens visiting America and saying, all they ever talk about is about their own destruction and decline. And Rome was exactly the same. I mean, Rome was also what I call a declinist state. And if you look at the states now, and you think about, you know, if you go back and look over all of the sort of all of this sort of national issues magazines, all the politics magazines, they're just full of people banging on about America's decline. And so, in some respects, and you've had the same thing with the West, with Britain as well. The reason why Carthage has sort of played such a big part in our sort of collective psyche in the West has been the concept of that it gets destroyed, you know, and that's what it's famous for more than anything else. And so, you know, that sort of moment in which this sort of great civilization is completely obliterated. And, you know, and I suppose why that's important to us to start with is because there goes us, but by the grace of God, you know, that we look and see what can happen. So that was where I started, and that's why I wanted to start with the destruction. But then the question is, why, you know, and what was this thing? And I think, I mean, I'll give you an example of this. I mean, when I made a television program about Carthage many years ago, and I'll never forget turning up in Carthage with this sort of TV director. He was a quite sort of upfront guy. And he, so we get onto the Bursa Hill, which is the main citadel of Carthage. And he starts freaking out, and he goes, "But there's nothing here." I was going, "Well, kind of, Dumbo, that's the point. That's why we are here."
That's so funny. And I guess that's it's. And for people who are listening, it's Carthage is sort of what Tunisia is part is on the tip of, I guess, what is today Tunisia in North Africa. When you get there, and this is we're talking about a civilization and that stood for 700 years. And by the way, and I think if I remember correctly, the wall that sort of you saw from the sea was the blocks of sandstone that were covered in plaster weighed something like 1,300 pounds each or something crazy.
Absolutely enormous blocks. Look, it was basically, yeah, this incredible city. I mean, it was the first big superpower of the Mediterranean. Wow. And why I wanted to write this book was because What tends to happen, what we tend to do is that we want to be seen, if we become great powers ourselves, we don't want to be seen as the sort of, as the person, as the state which is sort of standing on the shoulders of giants. We want to be seen as great in our own, you know, in our own right. And what Rome does is this, is that Rome, in its own ascent to greatness, basically sort of takes over the Carthaginian settlements all over the Mediterranean. It takes over Carthage's trade routes. So in some respects, Rome becomes a great economic power through what it learns from Carthage. But at the same time, what it does is it sort of eradicates the memory of Carthage. So in some respects, when we think about the ancient Mediterranean, what do we think about? We think about Greeks and we think about Romans. And we think that the Greeks were the clever guys were the kind of geeks who basically thought a lot but actually didn't deliver much, whereas the Romans were the sort of, you know, go-to guys.
Right.
You know, of course, that's a sort of terrible, terrible cliche. And I'm sure any of your listeners who have any Greek heritage or Roman heritage or Italian heritage jumping up and down.
But you're right. But you're right. You know, when you read Socrates, for example, the tradition that came, the philosophical tradition, Plato and Socrates and Aristotle, they sat around thinking of, and this was in the aftermath of a devastating war with the Persians, I believe. So they were a defeated country, and for whatever reason, they had the luxury of sitting around and coming up with these ideas that we still talk about today. So you're right. I mean, the Greeks, you're absolutely right about that.
I mean, but I think, I mean, the thing about the Mediterranean world is the Mediterranean world was basically a rich cultural stew. Mm-hmm. As rich a cultural stew as it is now. And, you know, if you look around, you know, if you look about who we consider to be Mediterranean people, and I use the pejorative sense of we, we think about people on the northern shores of the Mediterranean, don't we?
Yes. Yeah.
Or on the western shores. We don't tend to think about those people who live on its eastern shores or its southern shores. you know, and it is, you know, we're pretty selective, but even now, about how we want to view what we consider to be Mediterranean culture.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. You're right about
that. You know, and it's no different in terms of how we've decided to sort of delineate the ancient world too. Mm. And I think what I wanted to do was this, is that I wanted, the more that I looked into basically what Carthage had been, what the Punic world, what we call the Punic world, this, which is the sort of the adjective as such of basically of Carthaginian and Phoenician settlements across the Mediterranean world, I began to realize just how important it was. And that basically there had been this sort of joined up Mediterranean world long before Rome had, you know, Rome, you know, a time when Rome, I think I said in the book that Rome had basically been Hicksville on the Tiber. you know, yeah, at right. a time when Carthage was kind of at its pomp, you know, and they had settlements all the way from Spain, all the way, you know, in Sardinia, in Sicily, in Malta, you know, right, and as well as North Africa. So this really was a sort of, I think what I try to do with the book is quite simple, is that I tried to show that actually the Mediterranean is an even more complex and even more interesting place than we might think.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I you know, I guess part of what you think about with Carthage, or you think about with the fall of Constantinople, for example, or these stories you hear about the sort of falling of an empire. And by the way, it's a little bit different in today's terms, you know, as if the West is declining, quote unquote. Well, my feeling is that it'll be a slow and steady erosion of our national character. So to be an American, well, what's that mean anymore? You've got so many different cultures. It is a cultural stew. It isn't the traditional American, you know, baseball and apple pie as much anymore. There are a lot of different Americans, and that means a whole bunch of different stuff, depending on where you're from, right? We're becoming a Spanish-speaking, almost a bilingual country, et cetera, et cetera. So that would be a different kind of decline. But when I think about, say, Carthage, when they were starving the people and they were dying of, you know, they were starving and they were dying of disease. And finally, you know, finally you get these images in your head of you're trying to protect your family and these guys come in with swords and they're raping your wife and they're killing your kids. And, you know, all at least as a man, I probably think about that once a day, at least. it's literally in my DNA, and it's the reason I do jiu-jitsu and I box. I swear to God, I'm always getting ready. I mean, you know, it's so ingrained. And my ancestry, my genetic code must have gone through that many times because I'm always getting ready. I have an alarm.
The NRA are going to love you.
Oh, they sure are. But you know, I even when I talk about it on stand up, I'm a progressive guy in the sense, but when it comes to gun control in this country, I think, you know, I always say you're going to have a hard time getting people to give up their guns because the idea is men feel like without a gun they can't protect what they love. It is very, very ingrained in the American
mythology.
I think
it's impossible. I think it's in the American psyche. I used to live in in the Midwest in Wisconsin.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah.
And you know where there are more deer and cows than, you know, anything else.
I'm going hunting in Wisconsin on the 21st of November, by the way. the way, for this TV show. I'm shooting deer up there, so there it is.
Yeah, well, that's what everybody does. But, you know, I can, so I know exactly, you know, and of course, being a European, I just don't have that, you know, whereas I,
you paid such a price for violence in World War II. It was played out right in front of you. I think it's a different thing. We still have a bit of a mythology attached to the glory of combat in this country. Yeah.
But to sort of answer your question, look, I think there is, I mean, one of the things I tried to get across in this book also is about quite how brutal and violent the ancient world was. Mm. And, you know, and nothing becomes, you know, and at the same time, so that you, I mean, as I think I say in the book, that 146 BC, Rome doesn't just do it to Carthage. They do exactly the same thing to the city of Corinth,
right?
Which is one of the most important cities in Greece.
Yeah.
And the thing about both of these situations, especially the Carthage one, is they had a long time to think about it. Mm-hmm. So they planned it. It was premeditated.
And it makes it
it's so sinister. You know, this sort of idea that you decide that you're going to sort of deliver this sort of final solution. One of your great enemies. The fact of it was that by this time, Carthage wasn't even a big threat to Rome. It had passed. I mean, Carthage by this time was a shadow of its former self. Mm-hmm. So in other words, what you're getting, what I say in the book is this, is what I call the economy of terror. Mm. Now, these days, you can make threats, and we rarely have to make good on these threats. What Rome does is that Rome delivers two resounding sort of warnings to the rest of the world with Carthage and with Corinth. And they say, look, what we want you to see is the worst case scenario of what happens to you if you continually try and resist us.
I mean, it's literally the nuclear option. It's literally extermination. In the book, the way you describe when they're using, I guess, metal hooks to clear the path and throwing the living and the dead into ditches, and it's just women and children and those that did survive, or those that when the elders came with their olive branches, they essentially took 50,000 of them and sold them into slavery.
Yeah, and then look, that was your lot. It's winner takes all. There's no, you know, there are no sort of good outcomes. You know, if you lose in the ancient world, you lose, and you lose big.
Yeah, you lose big.
You know,
yeah.
We don't have any, you know, and I think one of the things, and I know it's a bit of an old cliche now. I mean, everyone's banging on about drones all the time. You know, there's some fat guy somewhere in Washington, you know, on his computer screen eating burgers, blowing up jihadis and stuff like that in their Land Cruisers. And we've become so detached from the whole concept of killing. Mm-hmm. And that's what all modern weaponry does. And so therefore, I think one of the things I also wanted to get across was the sense in which, with Carthage, these guys, these Romans, had to kill everybody by hand.
That's what I was thinking myself. I thought to myself, the smell of it.
And to kill somebody by hand without getting too macabre, you know, killing somebody by hand is not easy.
No, mm-hmm. No.
You might get lucky with one shot, you know, in the heart, but actually, on the whole, it is not easy. And so therefore, you know, just this whole, I wanted to get across this sort of apocalyptic sort of vision of trying to give the readers just a sense of what that might, even though I can barely imagine, what that might possibly be like. Because we're, you know, we are so removed from that world now.
Yes.
Okay, you know, I'm sure if we were living in Syria or somewhere like Iraq or somewhere like that, we would unfortunately be less removed from that world. But we are, you know, I'm sitting in Sydney. You're sitting in, are you in LA?
Yeah. Thank God, by the way.
Both of us, okay.
Yeah.
No, I'm in the Southern Hemisphere's version of LA, okay.
Yeah. Well, I kept thinking about, as I read the book, what it sounded like, what it sounded like as Carthage fell, as these men came in with their hatchets and their swords, what it smelled like. And there was this clinical, visceral sort of feeling that the book conveys. I thought to myself, it must have been, I mean, you know, just one of Dante's rings, man. I mean, you know, you think about how horrific it must have been. And like you said, it took, what, 6 days as they went through the streets and sister, and they rotated, they had to rotate their troops because, you know, killing gets exhausting, obviously.
It's a lot of
mentally more than anything else. I mean, sure. You know, there was something, I had to do this course for the BBC once, which was, I mean, I've made a few sort of TV documentaries for the BBC, and one of them, I did this one called Ancient Worlds, and this was about 2009-10, and we were going to go to Iraq, we're going to Basra, and we're going to Baghdad, going to Pakistan and a few other places. And so if you go to all those sort of places, they make you do this course. And one of the things that they really try and get into is just how difficult it is to kill another human being. Mm. And how few of us are actually mentally able to really do it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so therefore, I mean, one of the things again in the book is that, I mean, of course, it's difficult not to be anachronistic. You know, and I read tons of sort of more popular books, and you think, come on, mate, all you're doing, this is very anachronistic. You know, actually, this is not the way people in the ancient world would try and think. But what I, as I said, you know, just to go back to this point, I've really tried to get a sense of trying to get people to sort of engage with the horror of an ancient battle scene. Because, you know, otherwise, you sometimes read these books. I mean, I obviously had to read a lot of books about the Punic Wars. And often, please, you know, if there are any military historians out there, I apologize now. Don't come and get me. But sometimes you see these things and they've got all these diagrams of saying, and then the cavalry charged it. And I get I'm not a military historian, but I'm interested in war, but I'm interested in its consequences
and the human dimension.
Emotional consequences. Yeah. And I'd often get no sense of that, as if it had been, you get these sort of slightly sort of, you know, the sense of it just being a sort of a game.
Yeah.
And I didn't want, I wanted to get something, a sense of, you know, of how sort of down and dirty it is.
Oh, you do that so well in the book. It really, I was almost like, let's turn this into a movie, man. This is like, you know.
Great. Well, look, if there's anyone out there.
Yeah. Hey, we're in Los Angeles, baby. Let's see. Yeah. But, you know, again, you'd really capture, see, we have this tendency when you read about the Mongols, or you read about, and history's full of this, right? An army comes over the hill and you're tending to your goats and you look up and just see a dust cloud and it's just a bunch of barbarians on a horse. And you think to yourself, well, yeah, it must have been bad. Was it really that bad? I mean, would they really come in and just kill a bunch of children and things like that? You really only have to look 60 years, even less than that. What am I thinking about? You can go to Rwanda or any of these places, and you realize how horrible it really was. And it's hard to imagine that everything you've known and a city that stood for 700 years. I mean, if you weren't dead. You then were sold into slavery. What did that mean? What do we know about that? What did it mean to say, here's 50,000 people, you're going to funnel through this hole in a wall, and we're going to sell you to slavery? What did that mean? I mean, if you're a woman, if you've got two kids in your arms, what does that mean?
I think the first thing to say is this is about economics as well. I mean, Rome, during this period, as soon as you get, I mean, why does anybody have an empire? I mean, we dress it up in all sorts of sort of ways later on. With hindsight, we say, like the British Empire, they had that poet Rudyard Kipling who said, oh, it's all about the white man's burden. You know, we've got to go out there. We've got to conquer you. We've got to sell slavery,
you.
Steal everything to civilize you. You know,
I never met an Indian man who liked.
Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, never met an Indian man who liked Kipling.
I mean, you know, it's just, obviously, it's complete bull. But, in the end, what it's down to is because we're trying to get our hands on resources, and humans are resources as much as anything else. And one of the things you look at with Rome is this: is that once it takes over, once it destroys Carthage, once it conquers Greece, the elite of Rome become colossally rich, and slaves are part of that thing. Well, and what you do? Well, firstly, what you do is you take away all their land and you create these huge estates, and then what you do is you need cheap workers, you need people to actually work on these estates, and so you get slaves. I think one of our problems is that I think the ancient world mentally for us has never been so far away, for all sorts of different reasons. But I think one of the things to get across is this is a much tougher, shorter life than the mollycoddled lives that we have now. You said, you know, how could anyone kill children? And well, you know, I mean, think about it. I mean, in this period, 40% of children were dead before their second birthday.
Well, there were no vaccines. There were no antibiotics.
So your attitude towards life and who is going to live and it's going to be totally different from ours. You know, I mean, now we're incredibly sentimental about this. But also, think about it in terms of when did we start becoming incredibly emotional in terms of and sort of sanctifying children in terms of, well, that's quite a modern phenomenon too.
Amazing.
So what I would say is this is a shorter, more brutal, a much more dangerous life than the one we have now. And one can only imagine that, I mean, for us, it's very difficult to grasp, but if you lived in that world, then you'd probably make very different assumptions than the ones that we do.
Well, and one of the
things... Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, actually. It makes and as you put it into that context, it actually makes it a bit more bearable. I suppose you were always waiting for the other foot to drop. You were always, every single day was like...
This is,
you know, I've talked to soldiers in combat, elite commandos and things, and a lot of times the way they get through the stress of it is they just kind of assume they're going to die anyway. I've heard a lot of them say, I'm already dead. And these are the hardened Delta Force guys and stuff. I mean, I don't know how much of it is I don't know what they mean a lot by that. But it's an interesting mindset. You take on a different mindset, I guess. It's just, I don't know.
I think that's right. I think people have to. I mean, how do you kind of? I mean, you can't even imagine. How does anyone sort of mentally prepare for that? I presume you have to shut down.
I would imagine you're so close to death to begin with. I mean, you know, if you're just hunting or even slaughtering an animal to eat, you have the ancient world had a much more intimate contact with death. I mean, just with blood, with just, you know, they saw it every single day in their animals, in their children, in the elderly, who were probably, when I by elderly, by the time they were 45, they were probably dead.
Exactly. Look, I'd be a goner. I've got my last legs.
There it is. So would I, my friend. So would I, although I look very young. Now, Hunter was going to ask about child sacrifice.
Yeah, because, I mean, you were saying about the value of, like, life that we have for our children. Like, the Carthaginians were apparently willing to sacrifice their children for religious purposes.
Babies,
yeah.
Nice guys.
Yeah, incinerating them. I mean, look. There's been a massive debate about this, and it's still going on. The story is this: is that so Roman, Greek, and Roman sources who tend to be very hostile towards the Carthaginians. What they write is they say Carthaginians, in times of danger, would sacrifice their children by burning them in a great fire. Now, of course, that's a very sort of, you know, the Carthaginians are a Semitic people, and that's a the whole idea of sacrificing firstborn children is a very Semitic idea. I mean, just read the Bible.
It's there.
You know, it's this sort of, you know, something which sort of unites that whole sort of region. Therefore, the big argument was that people said, well, look, this is probably just not true. This is probably just propaganda. And then, in the 19th century, they found basically this place called the Tophet in Carthage, which showed that where they found lots of urns full of the charred remains of small children.
Nice. happy times.
But the argument isn't over because there are sort of two different camps here. There's a camp that say, look, these kids are already dead. Okay, and they are being, you know, the idea of doing your sacrifice is that you basically give your already dead children to you cremate them and you give them to the two main goddesses, the goddess Tanit and the god Baal. And then others say, no, these children actually are still are being killed. They are still alive. Now, I come down on the side of those that say that actually that some of these children were sacrificed. Not all the time. Some are already dead and some are sacrificed. So I'm sitting on the fence, basically.
Well, it wouldn't be a sacrifice unless they were already alive.
But basically the science, there's a chap called Schwartz, who's in Pittsburgh, I think, and he's been doing a lot of scientific analysis, and he is pretty convinced that these children were, you know, that child sacrifice was going on. Now, look, how are we going to put this into any context? Because actually, one of the things which meant that when people were deciding, when scholars in the 19th century were deciding who were going to be the good guys in the ancient world and who were going to be the bad guys, for a while, especially in the 18th and 19th century, people were fascinated by Carthage and saw it as a great civilization. But as soon as they started thinking that people were sacrificing their own children, they were sort of cast out as being sort of one of the sort of, you know,
barbarian,
sort of
non-Christian sort of, you know.
I mean, but if we turn this on its head and we say, well, look, you have got a big Roman army or somebody or Greek army out camped outside your door, and it's looking like Armageddon is coming your way. Mm. And you understand that you need to sacrifice your most precious thing, the thing that is more precious to you than anything else. Then what's going to be more precious to you than your children?
That's right.
And so that, you know, do you see, by turning that around mentally,
yeah,
you don't demonize them. You think, well, actually,
well, they're dead. They're dead anyway if they come in.
Yeah, no, right. Or even if they're not, you know, you're giving the gods the biggest thing that you have.
Yeah,
and actually, you know, and you think about the Bible. Think about the story there.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Abraham and Isaac?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's a so. In other words, you know, I think we have to be. It's really hard. We have to be very careful about putting our sort of bringing our values back that far.
Sure.
Because
sure.
Every, you know, in the end, everyone's going to be found wanting, aren't they?
Well. And by the way, take us through, and then I want to get into Hannibal. Take us through. You know, you hear the story of salting the earth. I mean, did they really raise the place so that there was just nothing there, and then salt the earth, or is that more
so
legend?
So the crops could never grow.
Disappointingly, they didn't salt the earth.
Ah, damn it! Ah, those humane Romans. Yeah.
Well, letdowns these Romans where they talked a good game.
Yeah,
but,
I was going to say, all they did was burn a bunch of babies
people,
and enslave people.
There is in Carthage actually. There is if you're working as an archaeologist, obviously you're working with stratigraphy, which is a bit like looking layers of a cake.
Mm.
And there is in Carthage, there is a particular sort of layer, which is like this black tide mark, which is just full of sort of burnt bits and pieces, which is the destruction layer from Carthage from 146 BC.
Really?
So it's a sort of burnt, yeah.
Wow.
And they did in the city center. It does look like they demolished a lot of buildings and they burnt down a lot of it. But then what they do about a century later is they build a new city on top, and they build this sort of huge platform on top of the hill. And build on top of that. So in some respects, that must have not only preserved some of the Punic city, but also destroyed other bits of it too.
Mm-hmm.
But in the outer lying areas, in the sort of suburbs, I think that actually they probably didn't destroy a lot of that. But the heart of the city, yes, they most definitely did. And they'd have had to have done that by hand.
Yeah.
There was no JCB to bring on site or something like
right,
that.
Right, right, right. Well, today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. And for a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code CALLEN8. Well, you know, let's go to Hannibal because, you know, as I read about, you know, let's take Genghis Khan, Napoleon, even Alexander the Great, but probably less so. But let's just take Genghis Khan and Napoleon and these Roman leaders, Hannibal, these great generals and stuff who came in and wreaked havoc. I always, as I get older, I start to think, I think these guys were just sociopaths. They were just these narcissistic sociopaths they were just the biggest assholes on the planet who just decided that it was all about them and human beings were objects. So but rather than being great generals, they were just willing to do horrific things. They probably were very charismatic and intelligent, but they were sociopaths. In other words, just huge assholes. And I mean, I'm being simplistic, but I'm also being honest about that. I always feel like these things are spurned on by some egomaniacal, sharp profile, charismatic profile like Hitler, and then the rest is history. I mean, they just leave nothing but a pile of ash behind.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there's been all this research recently, hasn't there, on psychopaths and about how actually we tend to think of psychopaths all being in padded cells somewhere,
no.
You know, in a sort of supermax or right. whatever, but they're not. They're actually running our banks.
Right.
Yeah. Everything else. That's we're right. all on a scale of it. You know, and actually we all need a bit of the inner psychopath to actually succeed.
There's a great self-help book there. Channel your inner psychopath.
Channel your inner psychopath, exactly. But you're right. I mean, you know, they don't have to be the ones killing you. They've done a lot of studies on there's a book called The Psychopath Next Door, and she talks about how it doesn't mean he kills people. It just means that his only way to relate to other human beings is by winning and dominating over them, by controlling them. You know,
he doesn't kill you. He sort of probably tries to poison your dog or, cut down your hedgerow or something like that.
Sure. And watch your reaction from afar. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But no, look, I think with these people, they've got to be giant egos to get thousands of men to basically follow you through, crossing the Alps by foot, In as it's coming up towards winter, you've got to have something, haven't you?
Oh my God, especially like, hey, let's
fight in battle.
Let's bring these elephants with us while we're at it. I mean, is that myth or is that true? Did he really march elephants?
No, he took the elephants, but they all, again, disappointingly, they all died bar one of them.
Oh, is that right? But,
I'm presuming if you and I decided to set off with a load of elephants across the Alps, they might meet a sticky end.
I was going to say, unless you've got very big blankets, because they don't have a lot of fur. And I hope you like elephant meat. Yeah.
But that one that made it across was really, really useful, right?
Yeah. Sorry?
The one that made it across the Alps was really, really useful. No, exactly. A total game changer.
Yeah. So there was one that made the entire trip then.
No, it did. The one did. But elephants are part of, they're more a psychological thing. They're like having like a massive tank, which sometimes works well, but a lot of the time breaks down. Mm. And so, in other words, they're very difficult to control. I mean, the problem with elephants in battle is they have no reverse gear. If they turn round, they'll just trample over you.
So,
in other words, they're not really the best one. But psychologically, and it's the same thing as we talk about with Hannibal and with all these other great guys. They've half won the battle even before you get on the battlefield. Because you're already thinking, oh my God, I'm now going to be facing Alexander or Napoleon or Hannibal. So what you're always trying to do is it's about the same thing as we do now, is that it's all about propaganda, about pushing a particular image of yourself to mean that, professional sports people, you must interview professional sports people.
Sure.
It's all mind games before the game, right?
Very much so.
And,
half
of it's won before you get on the field. One team already thinks they might lose and the other one is confident they're going to win.
That's right.
And so a lot of this stuff is about not only being a skilled general in terms of tactics, also you've got to be really lucky, and sports people will tell you that as well.
Sure.
You need luck at the right moment. Events have got to conspire your way. But also it's about the myth, about myth building all the time. So I'd say that the best way of thinking about some of these guys is to think about some of our elite coaches and sports, sports people.
That makes a lot of sense. Field generals. I mean, I watch a lot of American football, and I think about that all the time.
Yeah, well,
that's exactly
the best
what
thing.
They're like. Yeah.
Oh, of course it is. It's the most subtle. If you're a Brit, when I first moved to the States, watching America, watching your football. It seemed to be sort of just go on and on and on. It just seemed to be a game.
You gotta know what to look for, but that's so funny. We say the same thing about soccer, about your football.
Or cricket.
Yeah, oh my God.
A sport that takes a change.
No,
says the Brit with the 3-day long cricket matches. My God,
exactly.
Man.
The Ashes are going on at the moment. Look, don't denigrate that. But it's that whole thing. But one of the things what you notice with football, and of course, I was in Madison, in Wisconsin, big football, and it's how subtle. It's all in the mind, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's so subtle. This whole thing.
Well, it's a game.
It's so strategic.
It's a game of inches, and it's all strategic, man. Mm-hmm. It's all strategy. It is war. Those guys are tough, and they get injured, and it's everything. But it's a great deal of strategy. What do we know about Hannibal? What do we really know about him? What did he look like? Do we know what he looked like? Do we know?
We don't even know. All we know about him is he had a gammy eye.
He had a gammy eye. As in a lazy eye?
Yeah. Oh, no. It's such a good word, isn't it? A lazy eye.
Yeah, lazy eye. A gammy eye.
He got ill. He got ill when he was marching through Italy. He got stuck in a swamp and he got some infection and eventually lost his eye.
Oh, I see.
What does he look like? We don't really, but the thing about Hannibal is that we always think about him as being a Carthaginian. He only spent very little of his life in Carthage. He left there when he was 8 or 9 years old, and he only went back for a few years towards the end of his career. he is much more like he's much more like Alexander the Great. So in other words, he's what I call a Hellenistic general. He's a general who basically, in some respects, he fits into a sort of mold of sort of being a sort of almost like a sort of a Greek Macedonian hero. Mm-hmm. And he plays that game all the time, being sort of presented. And he presents himself as being the new Hercules.
Well, he had that wonderful armor that you describe, right? I mean, he was a theatrical man.
I mean, unfortunately, he was probably the Romans probably invented that armor, but he gives that sense in which you know, it's all about it's as we go back to this, we go back to this point again. That it's about how you present yourself. You know, everyone's got to believe in you because there's a very good chance they're going to die. Your army, people are going to be killed in the most horrible way. They need to believe that you are a winner. If they think you're a loser, they'll just kill you anyway.
Right.
They'll kill you and go over to the other side or do whatever. So it's a precarious game.
But I've always wondered how a general without microphones, without, you know, projecting himself on a big screen, how a general was able to motivate that many people with just his voice and his body from such a distance. I mean, I know you'd probably ride on your horse past your troops saying things, but there's a limit. I mean, you know, I guess he created a legend by word of mouth, which can be even more powerful. It's the guy you don't see sometimes that's easier to build up than the guy you do see.
Right? You need a bit of mystique, don't you? If you think about, again, I mean, if you're going to be a sort of great leader, one of the things you don't want to do is you want people to think that you're sort of superhuman. You kind of don't want them seeing you eating breakfast with your wife, do you?
No, it's true.
You know, the guy next door looks at it and goes, hey, you're exactly the same as me.
Right.
You know, and I mean, I know that slightly flies in the face of sort of watching the Kardashians or whatever else.
Yeah,
but
you're right. Creating mystery is everything.
Listen, I wouldn't follow Kim Kardashian into battle.
Yeah,
at all.
I wouldn't follow Kim Kardashian either.
You know, which one, guys? Which one would you follow?
I might follow her into the bedroom. I'll tell you that much. But that's just me.
But I think what these guys would do is, first of all, their commanders would be, their other commanders would basically be sort of geeing up their troops, but also it'd be more looking like you're wearing flash armor, looking, you know, and going up and down the line so people can see you.
Mm.
And this is one of the other things, is that the big game over in battles is if the general gets killed. Mm. And that's why the general's in the center, surrounded by crack troops, making sure that he doesn't fall.
Because
it's all of these battles, they're a complete confidence thing. It's like we go back to the sports analogy. In the end, as soon as the confidence, you start losing that confidence, you're lost.
Was it mostly swords and spears, or was it bows and arrows? What kind of weaponry did they
use? Used a range of different things. I mean, first of all, you'd have, throwing missile slings with stones, sharpened stones in them. Mm. You'd have bows and arrows. You'd have javelin throwing, but then when you got in close, none of those things are useful. Then it's you're using whatever swords you had. And remember, in his army, you'd have a whole range of, you know, you had a lot of people from all over the Mediterranean world, and so they'd all be using their own kit, which would be different.
Oh, wow.
Different types of kit.
Huh.
So it depends who they were. And you'd have people who were just specialists, people who did certain things. So you'd have swordsmen. You'd have those people who are spearmen, you might have archers, you'd have, as I said, slingshot throwers, all doing different things. But when you get in close, you know, you need a short sword or a dagger or something like that. Because there's not much room to sort of, you know, to sort of swing something around.
Yeah. Well, go back to Hannibal being a Hellenistic. When you say that, a general, I think of Alexander the Great, in that Alexander the Great really was his tutor was Aristotle, and he would go in and say, look, you can keep what's here. You've just got to be loyal to me and to we're going to change your educational system and things like that. But that's what I think of. So what do you mean by Hannibal being like Alexander?
I think Alexander in the end is sort of modernizes warfare. Mm. He does it in a number of different ways. And I think the most important way is that if you look to his staff that he took on his great march eastwards when he was conquering the Persian Empire, it wasn't just full in his camp. There weren't just generals and military strategists, but also historians, philosophers, all sorts of other writers. He brought his own PR machine with him. Hmm. And again, so he understood the psychology of war far better. Look, I mean, but you know, war originally, when it first, you know, war had originally been a bit like, we always think about Homer, don't we? We think about the sort of Achilles and Hector and this sort of idea of sort of individualized combat. Mm-hmm. Well, war wasn't like that at all. War was like an American football game without a ball. Actually, it was a lot of pushing and shoving, right. And actually not many people were killed.
Really?
If you looked at sort of small, if you think about in Greece, think about the small city states, you know, when they weren't getting their harvest in, they'd go and fight each other. And it would be like a sort of, I don't know, like a sort of American football game between two townships. And not many people would be killed. Now, what you find with Alexander is that with the sort of invention of the his is a much more of a killing machine. So they have their phalanxes. The Macedonian phalanx is like a sort of watching a porcupine with these sarissas, these huge long pikes with sharp ends. And it'd be like a porcupine advancing forward. It was like a sort of bulldozer.
Wow.
And the idea of these pikes is to basically make sure that no enemies can get close to you.
Were they on horseback or were they walking?
No, he's on foot.
Wow.
Okay, you'd have cavalry there as well. You'd sort of march forward. And then it's only later when you get in close, when you've got people to ground, that you can start killing them. That's where the killing zone is.
Hmm.
But more than so, you have all of that sort of technology, all that sort of strategy. But more than anything, it's also about winning hearts and minds.
Mm-hmm.
It's about making people think that you are invincible. And so it's the cult of hero, the cult of personality. And Hannibal fits directly into that mold.
Was he surrendered to a great deal, or did people?
He was. I mean, the reason why in the end he comes a cropper with you know, loses against Romans, that he misunderstands the Romans, because the Romans are different, and the Romans are different because they do not have a reverse gear. They're like the elephants. In that, what happens with a Rome is that Hellenistic warfare works in a very simple way. What you do is you go and beat up your neighbor. Until such an extent that eventually they turn around and they sue for peace. And then you're on top and you get a good deal. His problem was this, is that he kept on getting the Romans into a sort of stranglehold, in a position where he thinks that they will sue for peace. But they never do.
Mm.
They never do. They refuse to surrender. And fighting enemies that refuse to surrender is very, very difficult indeed.
Well, it exhausts you. It exhausts you. Right?
It's exhausting. They just exhaust them out. And the Hellenistic world never get that right about Rome. And they also think, because, I mean, Hellenistic kings, think about Alexander and others, it's all about, in the end, it's easy come, easy go. What you do is you might invade a bit of land, take it over, you exploit it. But if you need to trade it off for something else, you do. Easy come, easy go. With Romans, once they conquered a piece of territory, it becomes as Roman as Rome itself, and it's never to be surrendered.
Wow.
And so they're so difficult to fight against. And so Hannibal, in some respects, his problem in the end is that he does represent the old world. He represents the old Hellenistic world, whereas Rome is something new. And it takes them, you know, and they never really get to grips with what Rome is about.
Well, it sounds as though that was because, I'm going to guess here, that Rome had, I suppose, a philosophy in which they could moor into, a bedrock, a strong, I guess, vision, a goal sheet even, or something where they had a plan, this Pax Romana, whatever you want to call it, they, as opposed to coming in just to conquer land, I suppose, to say you did it. They were actually working to build a real empire, to string together an entire world, and to turn the world Roman. Is that the difference?
Well, I think in some respects, I mean, of course, when we think about empires are always sort of, we always start thinking about empires in hindsight. No one suddenly thinks, I'm going to get an empire. They suddenly realize they have got one.
That's interesting.
I think what you find with Rome is that the Roman Empire was the greatest political enfranchising act ever. Mm. So what you have is this, is that Romans gave you a choice. When they conquered you, there's a stark choice. Either we're going to kill you or you become Roman.
Right.
And
right.
Think about the biggest disaster. Think about a modern disaster. Think about Iraq.
Right.
The biggest disaster, and if you speak to all these military guys, they'll tell you The biggest disaster was the practicing political decapitation in Iraq.
That's right.
It was the biggest trap disaster. It's because they got rid of everybody who was associated with Saddam, and there was no one left.
That's right.
They had no army. They had no police force. You know, and they're still reaping. You know, it was like a disaster, and they'll never do that again.
Right.
You know, and what the Romans did was the opposite. The Romans left the leadership of those people they defeated in place. And they said, but now you're Romans, and you basically, you are doing this under our authority.
You know, you'd think that we would learn from history. You'd think that the Bush administration would have learned from history in that sense.
We learned nothing from history. This is why it's so interesting.
God.
You know, and we just watch, you know, they don't, you know, and also you got to remember that you had one of the most supremely intellectually arrogant administrations ever.
That's for
and
sure.
That sounds a bit political. I mean, they didn't think anyone could tell them anything.
No, they didn't.
You know, and there's one thing about, you know, one of the things about victory, and if you think about the sort of, you know, the end of the Cold War, and you think about that sense in which sort of one side really come out on top, is victory makes you deaf.
Mm.
Okay, because all you hear is your own kind of, you know, your own sort of self, you know, your own sort of sense of sort of triumph. And I think that's what happened for a while, for a very short period of time. I think everybody in the West, we went deaf.
Well, mission accomplished, and, right? I mean, you saw.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, and now we've got to sort all this stuff out. And so I think it's, with the Rome, there's a lot to learn from Rome, And it was just a fantastic system because you can never hold territory through having a powerful army.
No,
ever.
Mm-hmm. No, you can't.
What you need is to integrate people into your system. You know, and you would have thought, and if you think about what, you know, America, which is, perhaps the most dynamic place on earth, is dynamic because it understood about making people American.
Well, and I mean,
it's incredible. You go there, you come from abroad, and you go there. It's one of the things you really, really notice is this sort of ethos of incorporation. And in some respects, Rome were fantastic at doing that as well. But on an even bigger scale.
Well, and I mean, consistently, when you look at the empires that succeed, they're very good at that. Alexander the Great was awesome at integrating local cultures, you know.
Well, you are a historian, and if I tell me if I put you in charge, you are the historian in charge. Of the Obama administration, and maybe the administration that comes after that. Where is the U.S. in your opinion going wrong, and we can lump the U.K. in there as well. Where is the West, the traditional powers of the West, and let's just call it the past 50 years, the U.S., the U.K. Where are we going wrong, and where should in your opinion, and what do you think we should be careful of?
I think it's quite simple. I think firstly, I think stop the navel gazing about being in decline, because people have been predicting the decline of the West for about forever.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so therefore, and the rise of the rest. Well, let's just see how far they rise first.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and everyone gets worried about what's going on in China, but the fact is that most of the sort of statistics they're basing it on are basically made up anyway.
That's exactly right.
What are we judging ourselves against?
Well, when was the last time you used it? When was the last time you drove a Chinese car or used a Chinese computer? I mean, the innovation in that country is nowhere close to what the U.S. is able to do. So
I just think confidence in that way, but at the same time I think the lesson, look, who am I to tell anybody anything, but I think fighting too many wars at the same time might not be such a good idea.
There you go.
And also deciding why you're fighting them,
right?
You know, because again, you know, one of the things that if you looked at Alexander, things consistent message again and again and again, you know, how many times have we heard different messages about why we're in Afghanistan? You know, I don't know whether the American government is the same as the British government, but it seemed to sort of, the message seemed to change every week.
Of course.
Thinking, and that's an issue. You need to know why you're doing this stuff.
Why are we doing it?
Able to communicate that.
Yeah.
And I think somewhere down the line, you know, we kind of lost that one.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. We appreciate your time. You're welcome anytime. I have to make a confession. I could listen to you talk all day. He's got that. I would abuse that accent. We're the ones with the accent, but I would abuse that. I mean, it's beautiful to listen to you speak. He's got that baritone voice. I'd love to. You could rob a bank in this country with that accent, my friend. You could just walk in and go, I'm sorry to bother you.
Yes, of course.
I'm going to rob your bank now. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Then we can speak all the time. Can I speak to you in federal prison?
Exactly. Exactly. You are correct. Richard Miles, Professor Richard Miles, we really appreciate your time, man.
Well, it's a pleasure, guys. Okay, have a good day.
We you will. Too. Thanks. Thanks for the book, man. We're going to put your book up on our website, and we'll be pumping it. So,
all right. Thank you.
Thanks so
Cheers,
much.
Cheers, man.
Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye. That was awesome.
That was awesome.
Yet another enlightening show. No more comedy. It's just all academic shit. But if you want to learn something, you tune in to Brian Callen and Hunter Motz and the Brian Callen Show. I'm going to have to put Hunter Motz Show eventually.
No. It's the Brian Callen Show.
I just like having you kind of being the guy who books all the guests, who comes up with all the ideas, and I take all the fucking credit.
You're the Hannibal.
That's it, man. That's it. Thanks for listening, guys.
You've been listening to the Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.